Morning, everybody. So I thought that today I would sort of extend Steve's talk yesterday to still lower temperature, that is, still colder electrons from room temperature and above down to maybe 1,000 times lower temperature. And the interest in doing this is that this is where we may expect to see some new instabilities. And so I will show you some examples of these in this lecture. Let me begin by giving the names of the individuals that have been involved in the research I wish to describe. So there was, I'll draw some examples from the study of the border metallic ferromagnetism, and then make comparisons with corresponding studies on the border of antiferromagnetism, metallic antiferromagnetism, and ferroelectricity, which is a very different problem, but we'll see there's some relationship to the others. All of the effects that I'm going to describe are quite sensitive to disorder, quench disorder. And so they were not observed in the early studies. And it really appeared gradually over time as the samples have gotten better and better. And so sample quality, in some sense, defined in some sense, is very important for this work. And some of the samples are grown in Cambridge, but others have been grown in laboratories of our collaborators in Japan. I'll mention the names of the individuals again later on. So let me then begin with the story that has started many years ago, the problem of quantum criticality, on the border of ferromagnetism. In fact, if I continue along the lines of Steve's lectures yesterday, one could imagine cooling the system from high temperatures and looking at the way the crossover temperature from the conventional low temperature behavior to the unconventional higher temperature behavior, and look at, by some tuning parameter, try to reduce that transition crossover temperature down to absolute zero. And of course, the point that he made yesterday was very important, that the non-Fermi liquid properties, not the interest in non-Fermi liquid theory, has really been there all along. But it's simply, I think, focused a little bit more by looking at properties where the crossover temperature is actually going towards absolute zero. There are some advantages to doing this. One is that we can reduce the effects of phona, which is very interesting in their own right, but enables us to separate out some of the electronic effects from the lattice effects. And also, it enables us to look more carefully at the limiting critical exponents if they exist. It's difficult to do from the high temperature state. However, the problem of crossover from normal behavior is treated in terms of conventional theory of propagating quasiparticles, and then the abnormal one at higher temperatures has been there from the beginning. It just it wasn't really emphasized that much in the old days. So the standard textbook would talk about if the conditions were right, you would see a Fermi liquid. But what never discussed is what happens if the conditions were not right. And this was just sort of considered not a topic for, it didn't exist almost. Yeah?
It's a big issue whether this single or T equals zero phase transition exists for ferromagnet.
No, we'll see that this is, I'm starting with a historical picture,
yeah.
And you'll see very quickly that it's not like that.
So is it a theory plot or an experimental plot?
No, this is theoretical. This was actually the kind of picture that was drawn in the early 70s when the theory of critical phenomena was first introduced. Even the name was sort of introduced at that time. And of course, the early data was looked at from the point of view of this type of picture, where one has a effective quasi-particle Fermi temperature going to zero at some point, and a second-order phase transition to an ordered state, which in the early work was basically a metallic ferromagnetic state. And the idea was that the transition could be second order. There were, of course, people who doubted that this would, that reality would be described in this way.
Yeah, I think the status at the moment is people think it will never go to T equals zero.
The question that was raised almost immediately was, what happens to this huge degeneracy which starts to develop, since the quasi particle density stays in diverging at that point, and this large degeneracy is probably not sustainable. So but nevertheless, the idea was to go ahead with this picture and see how far you could go. And so, with this picture, the main problem was to try to understand criticality in this region where the T is zero, you're in the zero temperature limit, so you have a zero temperature critical point, which might be described by a Gilbert-Landau-Wilson type theory extended to include the dynamics of the order parameter. That was the original thinking. However, we now know this situation is very different, at least on the border of ferromagnetism. And the actual phase diagram, which is emerging from a combination of experiments and calculations as well, is that we start out with a second order phase transition, but we don't end up with one at very low temperature. At sufficiently low temperatures, in practice, in our case, it means below 10 Kelvin. Usually, not always, there are cases where this occurs even at higher temperatures. One sees a second order transition line bifurcating at a tricritical point into two sheets of first order metamagnetic transition. So that if you cross the green sheet here, you have a first order phase transition. And at first sight, so what happens though is that this is a critical line and a critical endpoint, and it looks at first sight that what has happened is that the critical quantum critical point has been shifted from the origin in zero magnetic field along this point, has been shifted off to the magnetic field, finite magnetic field plane. And so that you might think that therefore all that has happened is that we have a new second order phase transition at this point, which then can maybe be treated using the same philosophy of the fight of the four against Gilbert-Landau-Wilson type theory with dynamics included. However, even this proves not to be the case, because again, when you clean the samples, you find, as was presented earlier in the week by Andy McKenzie, that if you look carefully around this region here, you see in a phase transition, you never reach the second order quantum, the naked quantum critical point, but you see another phase transition in this region here, which is not simply ferromagnetism, but something else. And one of the proposals is that the state that emerges in this region is a type of Steve calls pneumatic phase. It can be viewed in this way. Suppose you consider a type of periodic table for two particle instabilities. So what we have here is particle-particle pairing, therefore supertransitivity usually. And here we have particle-hole pairing. And this is S wave or S isotropic or conventional pairing. And this is then non-S. And so this would include conventional superconductors. These are the unusual superconductors, D and P wave type or F wave superconductors. This would include all the spin density wave and charge density wave instability you're familiar with. And this is the sort of category which is seems largely empty at the moment, where you have anisotropic particle-hole pairing, so that you can think of it as particle-hole pairing the p-channel or in the d-channel. And it seems that the evidence is growing that the instability around this point is in this box, which is, apart from this, may be, I don't know if it's empty, but certainly, there are very few examples that you can say are definitively in that box. And that is then, in that sense at least, it's still a symmetry broken state. It is in the conventional Landau symmetry breaking framework, but it's different from the other one. Now, there's more. First of all, let me just point out that, or remind you, that the ferromagnetic state itself can be put into this framework, and it corresponds to particle-hole pairing in a conventional S-channel, but with that spin being a key variable. But the interesting one is a state that has been observed in a number of systems now on the border of ferromagnetism, which can be thought of as being this box, which is non-S-wave or P-wave superconductivity. coexisting in fact all the cases that we know about, is actually coexisting with ferromagnetism, or appears to be coexisting with ferromagnetism. And there's more. In this region here, sandwiched in between the first order metamagnetic transition, in some cases we see a state which cannot be thought of in terms of thermoliquid theory, nor in terms of the theory of the critical phenomena as was used originally, but appears to be connected with some unusual spin structure, an example of which is a skirmionic state, which might be a skirmion liquid. Now I'll come back to that later. So this is a summary, in a way, of what I want to talk about. That the border of ferromagnetism, which is thought to be, in some sense, the simplest case, turns out to be very interesting. But most of these effects are only observed in clean samples. So in the early work, all that was seen was a line coming towards this point with somewhat ambiguous critical exponents that could not be clearly understood. It's all been cleaned up by purification. So now, you might say, well, do we have any so-called naked quantum critical point where there is no first order transition or other instability that gets in the way? Well, there may be, and I'm sure the people here can name examples. Certainly in the theoretical model, there are lots of examples.
Sorry.
But experimentally.
Before you go on, I realize this is sort of a somewhat theoretical diagram, but you're pointing to various arcs and associating them with different materials. I mean, all these features are not seen in any one material.
Not in one. Well,
composite of
no.
Material,
yes.
Like
yes. That's. That's right. And there are actually good reasons. Some of them are alternative.
Yeah,
and cannot coexist.
The way you said it, it made it sound like this was, you know, the nature of a ferromagnetic one.
Yeah, that's right. I think I could, let me clarify that. Good question. I think what is seen in all the cases that I know of where the careful measurements have been carried out and good samples is the starting skeleton. Basically, what I showed you at the beginning. This is kind of like a skeleton which runs all the way through. And then the other properties are seen in different types of ferromagnets. Yes? Because I think, to some extent, they may be alternative. So if you get one, you can get the other. So I wanted to mention that there may be some examples, experimental examples, where the original theory of quantum criticality may work. And that is the border of so-called displaced ferroelectrics. Now, instead of ferromagnetism, we have a ferroelectric theory temperature going to zero as function of some control parameter. In fact, one of the most common quantum ferroelectric strontium titanate falls very close to this boundary, extremely close, with a dielectric function between 50 to 100,000 at low temperatures. And this is a prediction of what you might expect to see in materials like this. Strontium should show a behavior is expected to show behavior which is dictated by that theory of quantum criticality, phi to the 4 theory with dynamics. And when I speak about the phi to the 4 theory, I mean the 4th order term has a positive coefficient. And in the other problems, it's a negative coefficient, so one has three sort of phase transition. So the original model involved considering critical phenomena in the quantum limit in three dimensions plus one. So the dynamic is that of phonons, effectively, or photons, so that the mode that is becoming soft at this point is actually a polar optical mode. Where the gap is going to zero at ferroelectric critical point. And so the optical spectrum, which normally is written in this form, goes over to a linear form as kappa goes to zero, that is, as we reach the quantum critical point. Kappa is the inverse correlation length that make, a correlation wave vector. So in that case, theory of quantum criticality predicts an exponent, a divergence of the dielectric function as you come down in temperature in this green region here, which goes as 1 over t to this power, depends only on the dimension of space and the dynamical exponent. And in this case, you plug in the numbers, you get a power of 2. And that is, in fact, seen. This is an example of the plot of the inverse subtlety measured by Stephen Bowley and as a function of t squared. And there is a close fit to a t squared dependence over a temperature range of about 50 Kelvin. And so this is a case where, at least at first sight, we can use, there's no sign of a first order transition at the lowest temperature investigated, which means down to 100 millikelvin. And in the best samples that have been produced, and strontium titanate has been produced at a very high level for other applications. And however, if you magnify this low temperature region, you cannot see it on the scale. It has to be greatly magnified. Then you find actually that this, the inverse dielectric function has an exponent. It's a very small effect. But it's been measured very precisely. It's been measured in a number of different specimens with different level of purity, so it does seem to be there. And it's not a consequence of Quinch disorder as far as we can tell. That's the only sign of some problems. And it's something that still needs to be understood. So first approximation, you can think of this as an example of the original quantum criticality ideas. But even then, even here, there is something that needs to be explained.
So in this example, if you have z equal 1, it means that the particle from here has been kind of gapped out.
This is the point I want to elaborate on. Yes, the 3 plus 1 is marginal in the sense of quantum criticality for the phi to the 4 field theory. Therefore, first of all, there will be correction in the theory to t squared and logarithmic correction. However, you have to be really close to the critical point to be able to see those corrections that have not been seen. And they also don't produce, those corrections do not produce the first order transition. However, so that's if you use the standard RG approach. But there is a question here which I'd like to raise, that we know that in 3 plus 1 dimension there is a mechanism, this is the so-called Weinberg-Coleman mechanism, which if you go through the literature, you find leads to a logarithmic correction to the phi to the 4 term for the uniform mode. So therefore, the field theory, free energy, the function of the uniform polarization, should have a term of the form phi to the 4 log phi. This comes from the fact that you're at the marginal dimension. V plus 1 is 4. 3 plus 1 at the marginal dimension 4. That I have not seen. So there are many papers on quantum criticality for ferroelectric going back to the 1970s. But I have not seen any discussion so far on this Weinberg-Coleman effect. And I've asked people who work in the field, and they have no idea. David Kamenitsky, who started this work in the early 70s, did not know what to make of it. But it's a question I'd like to ask people here, in fact, is what is going on there? Why isn't it in the existing literature in the theory of ferroelectricity, quantum ferroelectricity? And what should we be seeing and looking for? Because, of course, the phi to the 4 log phi term gives you a first sort of phase transition. We don't see this. But it may be because we're not quite at the critical point. So the next step of this research is we're here, just slightly to the edge, you see. Because it may be the interesting things are happening very close in. So what we're doing now is we have an oxygen isotope of strontium titanate, which is actually ferroelectric. And with a very small pressure of 1 kilobar, it can be pushed across into the paraelectric, quantum paraelectric side. And should it be possible then to work with a very, very clean specimen starting at this end, and then we tune it into this region and see if we can find this phenomenon. But first of all, it would be nice to know what the theoretical situation is concerning the Coleman-Weinberg effect.
What frequency are you measuring the dielectric constant?
I'm sorry, I didn't...
What frequency are you measuring the dielectric constant?
These are deep, well, they go up to a 10
very kilohertz. Strongly frequency dependent.
No, not at those frequencies. That's very low frequency.
What I missed it.
Maximum of about 1 to 10 kilohertz. Yeah.
But is there, at higher frequencies, is there scaling frequency?
Well, I am not aware of any calculations either. I suspect the frequency has to be quite high. But I have not seen calculations on this. All the work that has been done is on the DC limit. At least for the uniform mode. The uniform mode. Okay, so now, so that is situation, and even in the ferroelectric, there's some interesting things.
There's also electric field dependence.
The electric field dependence has been studied, and you see that the fourth order coupling term, the fourth order term in the free energy, is positive. There's no sign of it going negative. No sign of the tendency towards first order. It follows something like an Arrow plot form. It looks quite simple in that respect. But we suspect that very, very close to the critical point, even here, there will be some anomalies. There will be no real naked quantum critical point, even in this case. But the ferromagnetic metals are probably more complicated because of the localized electrons, which give us these gapless excitations that can produce even more exotic phenomena. Because we're dealing with insulators in the case of the ferroelectric. And I just want to summarize a recent result by Laura Sibley in Cambridge in a cubic compound zirconium 2. Where you see a Curie temperature in this case, falling to towards zero, but there's a first order phase transition at the end, which has been observed in several laboratories. And what I want to focus on is the behavior of the resistivity, which is straightforward to measure in this case, and has the advantages that were discussed yesterday in Steve's talk. And what we see in the resistivity is a resistivity exponent, which is 5/3 in most of this phase space of pressure and magnetic field. And this is the pressure at which the Curie temperature goes to zero, the zero magnetic field. However, there is a wedge in blue where the 5/3 goes over, and the accuracy of the experiment, as we can tell unambiguously, that it goes over substantially lower exponent value, close to 3/2. So there's a sudden change in the exponent from 5/3 to 3/2 in this region. So first of all, I want to say something about, this is not expected by the quantum criticality theory, nor is, for that matter, the first order transition in its simplest form. So I want to say something about the t to the 5/3 resistivity. Here is an example of the resistivity, the function of t to the 5/3. This is a zero pressure. It's still close to the quantum critical point region, but it's zero pressure. And the inset is a plot of essentially the thermal resistivity, which is the ratio of the temperature to the thermal conductivity, subtracting off the T to the 5/3 resistivity. So we're actually plotting the thermal resistivity minus the electrical resistivity. And this has a linear form up to the temperature range of the experiment. And the electron, the phonon contribution to this thermal conductivity is subdominant in this range because the samples are so clean that basically the heat is transported by the electron. This was checked by looking at the variation of the thermal conductivity with impurities and taking the limit with essentially zero impurities. This gives us this nice linear variation. These are the only samples in which this type of experiment could be done among the ferromagnets, none of the other samples have the necessary purity to really see this. So we have two exponents, 5/3 for the electrical resistivity and linear at low temperatures for the thermal resistivity. And if we ask, how does this compare with the predictions of the traditional theory of critical phenomena? But of course, in this case, it's going beyond the normal phi to the fourth theory to obtain the transport coefficient. And the dimensions in this dimension of space is 3. If z is taken to be 3, the dynamical exponent z is taken to be 3, we then get a resistivity exponent of 5/3 and a thermal resistivity exponent of 1. The z equals 3 comes from the replacement of the polar optical modes we had in the ferroelectric by magnetic fluctuations or paramagnon, which are expected to have this form, where they relax as a function of q, as q times kappa squared plus q squared, with kappa squared is the distance you are from the critical point. So if kappa goes to 0, well, the prediction is of a cubic relaxation rate. Incidentally, this is the same form which is predicted for transverse photons in normal metals, in clean metals. Transverse photons in clean metals have a decay rate which is cubic in the wave vector. And it is known already in the 1970s that under those circumstances, Fermi-Liquid theory breaks down and would give rise to t to the 5/3 resistivity and t linear relaxation rate or thermal conductivity. Although the early work did not actually give these exponents, but that was produced a few years later for the same model. So this is actually somewhat analogous to the model of the coupling of electrons to transverse photons in metals. The difference is that in the case of transverse photons, the effect is very weak. It's a relativistic effect, and it's expected to be observed only in very, very clean samples in the microtemperature range. But here, this is coming out of the Coulombic interaction. It's a problem which is analogous, but coming out of a much stronger interaction. And the scales now are pushed up to the order 10 Kelvin rather than the microkelvin range.
Do you have other examples where this is perfectly verified?
The specific heat should go as T log T. Oh yeah, there are very, actually I don't have it here, but I have a list of a remarkable number of cases where t to the 5/3 is observed. But the thermal conductivity could not be measured because of the strong phonon contribution in the samples that were available. But t to the 5/3 is actually now seen in quite a few cases, maybe 5 samples, different thermal magnitudes.
And the k is a purity of the sample.
Well, the problem with thermal conductivity, which is actually, you see, the difference in these two exponents can usually be used to measure the dynamical exponent. It actually tells you what it is in this case, so to speak, if you use this model. But the difficulty is that normally the thermal conductivity in the temperature range of the exponent is dominated by phonons because the electron mean free path is not long enough. But it is in these samples. That's what was special. The mean free path in the samples is about 5,000 angstroms or maybe 10,000 angstroms.
So I think you mentioned that this t to the 5/3 is actually observed not only in the vicinity of the critical point, but also in the nearby phase.
Yes, right? But this is always the case. Because, of course, if you look very carefully, in other words, there's a region around quantum criticality where these exponents have validity over a certain temperature range. The validity in the theory extends to zero temperature only at a quantum critical point. What we're saying is that we are already very close, even at zero pressure, to that point. If we measure it in terms of kappa, then we can answer your question quantitatively by saying that the kappa that appears here, compared with the typical thermal wave vector, is small. And so the system looks like it is at a quantum critical point over this temperature range. But again, if I magnify this region down here, you begin to see signs of going over to t squared, which is an indication that we're not quite at the critical point.
Because I thought that the raw material is actually where you see t to the 5/3 basically over, down to very low temperatures.
Yeah, but not zero temperature, yeah. And of course, as we get really close to the the quantum critical point, you get a first order transition, and new things happen, which I'll talk about next.
Yeah, so it seems that if you extrapolate zero temperature, this T^5 term does obey Wiedemann flux.
Well, yes, and so that's right, because we, again, although this looks like a low temperature, it's still not low in that sense. You do have to go down to tens of millikelvin to be able to get back to that limit. So we're, in a way, we're still in intermediate temperatures. In some sense, it's like Steve Kibbleson's 300 Kelvin to 1,000 Kelvin. This is still high, even though it's down at 1 Kelvin, insofar as these kind of questions are concerned.
In your data, this extrapolation seems to go to zero.
Yeah, well, I think if you want to answer the question about whether or not Wiedemann Fonsol is established, you have to blow up and re-examine what's happening really carefully below 1 Kelvin. And there are other complications that occur. Rho zero is becoming important, the effects of rho zero and its temperature dependence. And also there are micro-inclusions of superconductivity at the lowest temperature. We don't understand where that comes from, but there are regions of the samples that are actually superconducting. You begin to see some of this below about half a Kelvin. And so it's difficult for us to analyze the data at lower temperatures to be sure that we have a violation of Wiedemann Fonsol. But I believe you have to go to very low temperatures to check that out.
Simply it's satisfying. That's what's... Simply the higher temperature data, if you, without measuring at lower temperature, if you just extrapolate that, at least on this course plot, it looks like it's satisfied, which...
Rogos is still low, high thirds, and Papa Otigo is steep.
No. So what's part of there is a difference, right?
Maybe I'd like to go through this point with you in detail, actually, see if maybe we can do something. But I'm slightly worried about the analysis of data at really low temperatures and even so. Because I know that there are complications start to show up. It may not be interesting one. They may be due to this, even though they're a very good sample, they're not perfect, and you get some stacking faults and dislocations. It's actually starting to produce some effect.
Can you just amplify a little bit why you plot this delta as W minus rho here?
What?
Why are you plotting deltas? What is the...
Oh, the reason for... Yes, so I should explain that. So actually, the next order term in the thermal resistivity is actually rho, so it's 5/3. So if I... So by subtracting rho from W, we're taking out the T^5/3, and we're extending the range where you see a linear form.
The linear one is the dominant one in principle at low temperature, but you're saying the 5/3 part is still...
Yeah, but it's obviously the linear term, dominates. So if I did, so I plotted just W here, instead of W minus W, you would see linearity up to about 3/4 of this range. That's all. It would be almost the same.
You said it didn't agree with the theory, or it doesn't agree? It looks like it doesn't agree.
It does. Yeah, I mean, it seems to be consistent so far as it goes with it. Yeah. And in a way, I think this is the first time we've been able to say this. Because, well, the resistivity of 5/3 has been around for a long time, but it's nice to see that we can also understand the trend. Because, and so Steve mentioned something important about resistivity that has also bothered me for a long time. Where does the momentum go? And all the models that are used, somehow this is hidden in there someplace. And you wonder if, when you're dealing with non-frim liquids in particular, whether such cavalier treatment of transport could be misleading. So we wanted to measure the thermal conductivity because that problem of momentum transfer is not actually relevant. And so we think that this is more definitive in that sense. Also, notice another interesting thing, that we're further away from semi-liquid behavior, because of this 2 here is actually due to the fact that the resistivity sensitive is weak for small angle scattering processes. So it's the same, this is the same 2 that would appear for phonons. For example, if we had phonon scattering, we would have D plus 2 over Z is 1 in that case, and you get T^5. Whereas if you look at the relaxation rate for phonons, you get TQ. So So we are further from the Fermi liquid T squared here. It says nothing's also informative. And it's very close to the relaxation rate of a marginal Fermi liquid. It's linear in T and omega.
The width and temperature on which the theory is valid is pretty big, I think.
Since we have a Fermi net, the whole thing. Well, I think it's big if you are comparing it with heavy fermion system.
Yeah.
But you see, all the scales are increased here. We're dealing with D metals.
Oh,
okay. So what might be 10K in heavy fermion system is, you know, more like 1,000K. And so 10 Kelvin here is actually a very low temperature from the point of view of the bandwidth, of the starting bandwidth. It's still very low temperature. And notice, by the way, we're not very close to Lenstein's a quantum of resistivity here.
So if you go higher up in temperature, at what stage do you lose this T to the 5/3?
Oh, how high does it go? I think, of course, we cut this off and started to deviate from 5/3. But I'd say that, that if I were to make it a more extended plot, I believe it's 15 to 20 K at zero pressure. But it is lower at higher pressure, but yeah, very high. But remember that the effective spin fluctuation frequency temperature is about 1,000 K. So this is still very low in terms of the phonons. This would be like, you know, being more 10% or so of the Debye frequency or lower, 5%. Again, it is important to realize that the energy scales are much higher than heavy fermion system. More like high TC actually.
And the scale is known. I mean, how do you know?
Oh, so you're wondering if we can understand why it should be 10% or 5% of? Yeah, we do understand that. And it's similar to the problem of, in the case of the Debye model for phonons, the T cube extends up to roughly 5-10%, 10% or so, I believe. And that has to do a lot with the nature of the spectrum, omega going as Q. And similarly here, their spectrum goes as a Q to the 3. If you include this in the picture, you do find that the range of the T to the 5/3 would be limited to about 5% of the band of the spin fluctuation bandwidth. So it's connected with how rapidly omega goes to its Q. Is an important factor in this. More, of course, eventually, when we go about 30 or 40 K, the electron phonon scattering starts to come in as well for the resistivity of the electrical resistivity. And we see that as well. Okay. Now all of this, I mean, both of the problems I've discussed so far appear at first sight to be understandable using the conventional approach, although we're still dealing with unusual situations, non-Fermi liquid. But this wedge here with T to the 5 is really puzzling, and it doesn't fit in any of the pictures that I'm aware of from the old theory of quantum criticality. Something different is going on here. And it was first actually this T to the 3/2 resistivity regime was first seen by Chris Slider in MNSI, and he followed this and studied and looked at a number of other properties, including neutron scattering, and found that he and his co-workers found that what happens in this region where you have a T to the 3/2 resistivity. Here's a plot, by the way, in this case, a resistivity versus pressure, and you see a rapid jump here to something around 3/2. And in this case, the resistivity plot is a logarithmic derivative with a function of temperature, and it's roughly 3/2 over 3 orders of magnitude in temperature. In fact, measurements were made down to 2 millikelvin. So at least very close to this region, it's really non-Fermi liquid down to incredibly low temperature. Yet the transition is first order, so that surprises us, because we expected, of course, that because it was first order, we expected it would be very boring. We would just get T squared on this side and T squared on the other side, because there's a sudden jump from the order state to the paramagnetic state. We don't see 5/3 at all in this case. And the reason for that is because the free surge transition is much larger in M-inside than it is in zirconium-Z2. So when we go into the magnetically ordered phase, we're already, the Fermi temperature is jumps up to 10 Kelvin. So in the measurements that we're making below 10 Kelvin, we see T squared resistivity. And we should, and we expect that T squared on the other side as well, all the way across. But in fact, you see this jump down. And the neutron data suggested that the magnetic order was becoming inhomogeneous, but there's still some sort of partial order on this side. MNSI is a somewhat unusual material. It's a B20 crystal structure which does not have central symmetry, which means that if you start with the ferromagnetic order and then turn on the spin-orbit interaction, the ferromagnetic moment develops a spiral. This is an intrinsic property of a system with spin orbit and without central symmetry. So therefore, in the ordered phase, you see wave vectors on these points of a very small q, nearly ferromagnetic. We can call it incommensurate ferromagnet. Very small q, pointing along the 1-1-1 direction. So these are spirals with the q vector pointing along 1-1-1. And the pitch, the wavelength, is about 200 angstrom. And that twist of ferromagnetism into a spiral is a consequence of spin orbit, coupled with the lack of emergent symmetry. As you go above, the spirals remain, but their direction becomes more or less random. So that's the most important point. There's also a shift from 1-1-1 to a center of gravity at 1-0-0. But the magnitude of Q remains almost the same. So it's basically as if we have spirals, but with the direction of the spirals changing in a random fashion on the surface. Not random, but changing over a wide range of direction. And the picture that has been suggested to explain data such as this and other measurements is that what occurs is that the spirals are there. They superimpose coherently to produce a spin texture or a spin crystal. And this is one possibility of a spin vortex which developed, or a skirmion system. And this is a simple picture in 2D of what it would look like. And it's very much more complicated in 3D. But this basically comes from, the existence of spirals, and the fact that these spirals apparently add, in some coherent manner, what we thought was a paramagnetic state, and give rise to a spin crystal state of some sort, this being one possibility.
This is
to do with the motion of electron through the vortex. This is connected with intensity and direction.
What is the color?
Oh, the color. It just reflects the different changes in intensity, because this is in this case we don't. It's a metal, and so the size of the local moment can fluctuate in magnitude. So that's part of the reason for it.
So blue is small.
Yeah. Well, actually. I wouldn't. This is schematic, and I wouldn't. So it really there's still a great debate about exactly what this texture is, and I use this only to illustrate what it could be. And so there's something very interesting is happening. But the question is, so for a while everything seemed to depend on the lack of inversion symmetry in the spin-orbit interaction.
So are there bright peaks in this phase or not?
Are they what?
Bright peaks?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, you see bright peaks which is broadened. So this is because, okay, so we don't have a nice periodic magnetic order. You're wondering about bright peaks coming from a lattice of vortices, probably.
Is it a well-defined lattice, or is it some kind of...
No, I think, okay, so this is debated, but I believe it's a liquid. Because the neutron scattering cannot tell the difference because the fluctuation is very slow. But muon spin resonance experiments suggest it's not static. Therefore, you should think of this as some kind of thin texture which is slowly fluctuating. It could be a kind of vortex liquid. A vortex liquid of skirmions. That could be a possibility. And then a lot of work is being done on this, and it's not settled. This is, in a way, you see how transfer can tell you something unusual may be happening, but actually understanding what that is a big undertaking. It takes a long time.
So in this model, do they succeed to
trade
half exponent?
Well, okay, so that's right. So, but at least in Kirkpatrick, very few people are willing to commit themselves to this, to answering that question. But at least in Kirkpatrick, you have a picture based on skirmions, which does give 3/2. But it's actually not a simple picture that I can give a hand-waving argument for. And in fact, I'm not sure it's established at all. But there is at least one proposal, yes, that a skirmion lattice could produce. But I don't believe it's been settled in a way that everybody would be happy with. Okay, so, but here's the catch. We have a mechanism for producing spirals, and then these spirals may coherently superimpose, giving you interesting in crystals or liquid. But in the case of zirconium vein 2, we have a center of symmetry. And yet we see the same, what looks like the same phenomenon in the transport properties at T to the 3/2 resistivity, which means that there must be other, if this is correct, there must be other mechanism for spirals to develop. Fortunately, there are plenty of mechanisms for spirals to develop.
What do you mean that it's not a spiral for zirconium vein 2? It's central symmetry.
That's right. It's simple cubic system, SEC. And it has a central symmetry. And it has no ready-made mechanism for producing spirals. There's no Maria Jelushinsky-type mechanism. And yet, and that was one of the reasons for studying zirconium vein 2, to see if we needed that physics to understand the T to the 3/2 state.
So is there anything unusual in specific heat to either of those materials?
Specific heat is, specific heat has been measured only up to the critical pressure, but not above. But this has actually been, an experiment is being set up by Jean Lorem, who has a differential calorimeter of very high sensitivity, and we're combining forces with him to do very careful study of the heat capacity up to about 25 kilobars and so. So we should be able to answer that soon. Okay. Now, there are other ways of getting spirals. I'd like to mention them here briefly. So one way is as follows. If you have a Fermi surface, which is close to Van Hoof singularity, as you see here, is actually the case, in the case of Strontium-Ruthenay for the EXY orbitals. And there is a small Q nesting here, which leads to peaks in the Linhart function that are shown here. These small Q features, these do not show up in Jellium. So models based on Jellium will not get this. But they do show up with these Umlauf processes in a lattice, and can produce low Q features and low Q spirals automatically. Now, in order to actually get ferromagnetism, in many cases we know you have to be close to a Van Hoof singularity to get a high density of states to satisfy the Stoner condition for ferromagnetism. And so I think it's sort of also ready-made in the sense that to get ferromagnetism, you have to be close normally to a Van Hoof singularity. If you are, you have finite Q peaks and small Qs, which can lead to spirals. So this is one proposal for generating spirals. Another one, really a much more exotic one, is connected with what is called the non-analytic correction to Fermi liquid theory. So this one, so far, most of the things that I've talked about are very intuitive, even if it may be difficult to work out rigorously, but they're quite intuitive. But here comes something curious, which is not at all intuitive. What comes out of these calculations is the following. But if you have a spin-polarized Fermi surface, and you reduce the spin polarization more and more and more, even in Jellium, we don't need a lattice, we don't need lack of inversion symmetry, we don't need spin orbit or anything, just a simple Stoner picture of a spin-split Fermi surface. And as you reduce the splitting more and more and more, this theory says that spontaneously, at some point, when the splitting goes below some threshold, you get a spiral. and you get a proliferation spiral. This is, we know how it's obtained formally. It comes ultimately from the following, that if we consider the interaction of a particle and a hole, remember earlier I talked about particle-hole instabilities, and connected with that is an interaction between particles and holes. And if you consider the interaction, which is due to the virtual creation of particle-hole pairs, you get this effect. So that you go from the first order transition from a uniform ferromagnetic state into a spin spiral state, which could be a textured state by superimposing a spiral in a coherent way. And that could give you a skirmion lattice or possibly liquid. And so it's all coming from, in the theory, it's coming in a way from a simple idea of an induced interaction induced by the virtual excitation of particle pairs. And I think the reason why it hadn't been worked out before is the following. Particles and holes automatically attract strongly by the Coulomb interaction. So why bother putting a small correction on top of that? Well, if you do, you get the surprise. You get nonlytic terms in the free energy. You get Q squared log Q terms in the susceptibility. And these are the kinds of terms that generate ultimately the spiral. So it had been missed, I think. People underestimated how a small correction could actually change the physics. Since we already had a strong attraction between particle and hole pairs, it didn't seem necessary to look for small additional attractions or repulsions on top of that. That was a surprise. However, the one thing I see that we're running close to the end. And so I'd like to mention, though, there's an interesting thing about this interaction. While it had been dismissed for the particle-hole channel, of course, it hadn't been dismissed for the particle-particle channel. It is precisely that, in the early days, was proposed to produce pairing of carriers due to the electron-electron interaction. So the particles coming along in parallel spins would exchange particle-hole pairs, producing an attraction where in the Hubbard model there is no attraction between or repulsion between parallel spins. So it's something that could produce p-wave pairing. And it was basically the basis, very similar to the kind of ideas that were used to explain superfluidity in helium-3 in the old days, and was used to predict superconductivity on the border of ferromagnetism. But what was not known in those days is that this same interaction could also produce spirals, and that these actually might, in fact, dominate. So if you want to see the original kind of superconductivity, you have to inhibit the formation of spirals. And the way you do that is by having uniaxial ferromagnetism. So we could look carefully at uniaxial ferromagnets where it's just not possible because of the strong spin orbit to rotate the spin. We might then see the original pairing of particles due to the exchange of virtual particle-hole excitation. That was part of the idea of looking at these materials that I'm going to mention next. So this is an example of a uniaxial ferromagnet. So far, all the ferromagnets we discussed, well, we only discussed two so far, are actually Heisenberg type. So there is spin rotational. The spin orbit interaction is not negligible because that gives us the Maria Dzerzhinsky effect, but it's weak compared to these materials. In these materials, the spins are locked along a particular direction. They can fluctuate in amplitude, and the spirals cannot occur. So now you can ask, let's look at the possibility that particles can exchange induced particle pair excitation, see if you can get superconductivity. And actually, starting with the work of Saxena and his team in uranium-germanium-2, we now have four examples of uniaxial ferromagnets where superconductivity is actually seen. This is the most recent example where you see a Curie temperature coming down with a superconducting dome, which, of course, is very familiar on the border of antiferromagnetism, but very rare on the border of ferromagnetism, and has only been seen so far clearly in materials like this.
What happens to the blue line when it hits the superconducting dome? Like this, the left half is also ferromagnetic?
Yes, I mean, this whole region is ferromagnetic, is that what you mean? Yes.
So that's coexisting.
It's coexisting. Now, that has been a disputed point. But there are quite a bit of data now, NQR, NMR study, that suggests that they really do coexist in the same sort. And the two best studied cases are probably, well, three of these have been carefully studied now. Uranium, cobalt, germanium, the most recent. Uranium, germanium 2, the original. Uranium, rhodium, germanium. And these materials, there's a lot of evidence of coexistence of both superconductivity and ferromagnetism. And that, moreover, the ferrum, all the way through, the ferromagnets that I've been talking about, it can be connected with Fermi surfaces. That is, connected with the itinerant electrons. Not ferromagnets due to some local moment.
Was it P-wave? Each
carbon
tar
is
P-wave?
Yeah, I didn't catch that.
Each
carbon tar
is P-wave?
Oh, well, again, this is also being carefully investigated. The consensus now, it is P-wave. And also, it's very hard to see it could be anything else. In the presence of ferromagnetism.
Yeah, sure.
Even if the mechanism is disputed, I don't think most people would doubt that it's going to be, it have to be a P-wave type pairing state.
Yeah, it's my next but, question. Is it understood why speculativity emerges close to this linear axial?
The argument is something like this. First of all, we don't have the competition of spirals. In my opinion, the spirals steal the show, possibly. But there's one more thing. In the Wilson, in the Macmillan formula for TC, you may remember that we have in the exponent 1 plus lambda is the electron phonon, and the denominator, there's usually an electron phonon lambda. But here, it's one-third of that. The reason is because for parallel spin pairing, the longitudinal modes are pair-forming, but the transverse modes are pair-breaking. And by getting rid of the transverse mode, we actually enhance, even within the Macmillan-type theory, we enhance TC enormously. So there are two things that favor this. One is the elimination of the competition from spiral, and the other is the elimination of transverse modes that are pair breaking in the P-wave channel. That
could it be a Coleridge-Ingel anomaly, which could be enhanced close to a Faradic QCP?
Like anomaly, what did you have in mind? What kind of
Coleridge-Ingel mechanism for P-wave pairing? Could be enhanced close to the
RGPCP? Well, I think it is enhanced in these materials, yes. And that's why we think it occurred. But while there a lot that can be said about this state, the coexistence of superconductivity and magnetism, the P-wave pairing and so on, the mechanism is still not completely settled. So I suggested a possible mechanism. But what is interesting about the mechanism that I've been discussing is that it actually produces both the spiral when you have rotational symmetry variance, spin invariant, and superconductivity when you have uniaxial. So it's quite nice that way because it allows one to unify these two problems.
So there's no ferromagnetic transition under the superconducting
zone? No, there is. It's ferromagnetic all the way down. It's not transforming from ferromagnetic to superconductivity. It's actually both.
So the transition, the blue transition line extends down?
Yes, yeah, well, yes, of course. The reason we don't see points here is because it becomes so steep that it's hard to do the measurement and be sure that the transition becomes broad. It's not disappearing. Although I have to be careful about that, because there is still, of course, in all of these kind of systems, a background first order transition. But the first order transition does not necessarily mean that the Curie temperature falls suddenly to zero. But it does mean that beyond a certain point, the magnetization changes abruptly. So in uranium germanium 2, you see a curve like this. But someplace up here, the ferromagnetic magnetization changes abruptly, so it actually becomes first order. But the Curie temperature continues to be fairly monotonically falling. Yeah. And then in order to see the Curie temperature here, you'd have to really sweep this way rather than this way.
I think what he's asking is, if you're in the superconducting phase out to the right, there is no ferromagnetism.
Oh, yes, definitely, yeah. The ferromagnetism is definitely gone beyond this point here. Yeah, sorry, I didn't miss that.
So it's a crossover or transition?
Well, I'm not sure it can answer that. In other words, in this region, making measurements vertically is a big problem. So to be able to answer that question, one would like to tune the pressure, and that will be coming as well. So you can make measurement lat sideways, which makes a big difference.
Do you still have T5/3?
Okay, so that's good. So no, you do actually, in one case, one of these materials has 5/3, uranium, iridium. The other ones are like M-5, because I think the first order transition is sufficiently big that you retain T squared. But the thing is, the first order transition is sufficiently small, then a 5/3 can be a reasonable approximation, because you're sandwiched from above by phonons, so you have a window, only a limited window you can work. So in principle, you would expect to see 5/3 at higher temperature.
What is the right temperature?
Yeah, I mean, when you get above about 30, 40K, the phonons start to dominate. So what this means is that 5/3 might be there at higher temperatures, but it's always hidden by the phonon. Yeah.
So for a uniaxial ferromagnet, as far as I remember, in the same way that this spiral instability is eliminated, there is also no inherent reason for a first-order phase transition.
Oh, that's true. That particular mechanism is gone too, you're right. So now we have to look for a different mechanism for first order. Now the interesting thing about first order is, I haven't spent a lot of time on this, but there are actually quite a few mechanisms that can give you first order. One of them is the nonlinear correction idea. That's only one, though. The other is having to do with proximity to Van Hoff singularity can give you first order. Coupling to the lattice can give you first order. And actually, there are several others as well.
Competition with superconductivity, maybe? Coexistence with superconductivity could be also first order.
Yes, even just, that's right. So even the coupling between these two order parameters can generate first-order transition. Actually, it's quite hard to get away from first-order. But you might be able to say that it's a weak, especially weak effect, that you can use a simple theory as if it were second-order. But, yeah. What I'll do is jump over. So I wanted to make comparisons between the ferromagnets and the antiferromagnets. I just want to mention one thing. While the superconductivity on the border of ferromagnets is very rare, it's only been really discovered in the last decade, on the border of antiferromagnets, we now have, I believe it's running into the 50 to 100 examples, where you see superconductivity emerging on the border of antiferromagnetism. This is an example here, where if you take a cubic material, ceramidium-3, which has a nail temperature starting at 10 Kelvin coming down towards zero here. And then there's this very tiny superconducting dome. If you introduce into the system some additional planes to turn it into a tetragonal structure, antiferromagnetic transition temperature falls, but the superconducting transition actually expands massively by an order of magnitude in temperature and in pressure. And it's an example that is demonstrated to at least some people that the lattice anisotropy is important. Because in these two materials, the electronic structure is fairly similar. But in one case, the Fermi surface is 3D. In the other case, it's more closely 2D. And it's speculated that, in fact, the two-dimensionality is important for getting ITC on the border of antiferromagnetism. This is one example out of many now, which include, of course, D electron system as well as F electron system, and P electron systems with carbon-based materials having quite high TC on the border of antiferromagnetism. That would be like cesium-3, C60, is very similar to this in a qualitative appearance. They just mentioned, though, that we tend to forget now. There's so many examples that people have forgotten there are cases on the border of antiferromagnetism that are not superconducting. And I just want to show one interesting reason for this. This is another material, another heavy fermion system, ceruleum-2, that can be produced in very high purity state. It's cubic. The resistivity exponent is pretty much normal until you reach the critical pressure for antiferromagnetism to go to zero, and at that point it drops suddenly almost to one, the resistivity of one. Not 5/3 that we saw on the border of ferromagnets, but one. And in this case, it looks like it's sort of straightforward above and below. It's just very, very close to the transition that you see anomalous behavior. But what is interesting is, more interesting, is the behavior of the residual resistivity shown here, is rho zero microcentimeters versus pressure. And as you approach the critical pressure, the quantum, the antiferromagnetic quantum critical point, you see the residual resistivity is diverging, appears to be diverging. But it's a really dramatic effect. We've never seen anything like this before. But this may be because we've only recently been able to tune the pressure very, very precisely at these relatively high pressure using diamond anvil cells. And this is the work of Joe Wensley, which was quite surprising to us. She expected to see superconductivity in this region. Instead, she sees basically a tendency towards almost an insulating phase. And you can extrapolate this divergence, and it looks almost as if the electrons are trying to localize at this point. This very high rho zero must be very strongly pair breaking in any kind of anisotropic channel.
But how does that compare on, if you've got different crystals with different residual, zero pressure residual resistivity?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
So the question was, how does that depend on the amount of disorder?
So oh, yes.
You'd have different crystals with different
right.
zero
yes.
pressure resistance.
Yes. Okay, so actually, you start off with something which has about a half a micron centimeter residual resistivity. It translates to about 2,000, 3,000 angstrom E3 tau. And then they're shooting up at this point. Now, the effect that, actually, I can't answer that quantitatively for you because we only had good samples in this case. It turns out that cerium aluminium 2 is self-purifying. Uh-huh. You have to irradiate this material.
Can't crap it up in some way.
This is an unusual.
I know
this is a very unusual.
People don't like taking their nice crystals.
But we want to look at that. Uh-huh. We have to introduce impurities somehow. It shouldn't be a problem. You might think it's not a problem, but your own mentality is against it. We'd probably irradiate these things somehow and introduce disorder. So this is really shocking. It reminded me of, at least was shocking, it reminded me of the story about Cornelius Onis, who believed that he would eventually see a divergent resistivity at that temperature. So when his technician came up with data showing zero resistivity, you know, it was a bit distraught, a bit annoyed, I would say even. It was going the wrong way. And it took about a year and a half or so to be convinced that it wasn't an experimental error. So Joe Wensley had the opposite experience. She's looking for superconductivity and had this divergence. So I cheered her up and say, actually, this is really interesting too.
So
in fact, now that we have so many people on the border around the Fermat, this is more interesting to us. Yeah.
So all the bands have to localize, not just the heavy F band. All the bands have to localize.
Yes, somehow. But I guess that's right. Yeah, I mean, actually, it's a good point because in some cases of heavy fermion system, we see there are light electrons that remain light even though the other electrons have masses of several hundred. But then there are other kinds, like uranium platinum 3, where all the electrons become heavy with comparable amount. So yes, that's right, because otherwise we would short circuit. That's a good point about this case. So now I need to close. So I'm going to bypass the story about the D metals. And let me go actually right to the end. I just want to speculate the plot here. So this is the inverse of temperature plotted versus the tuning parameter. It's the opposite of the plots that you've seen so far. Upside down. So here is the usual line that goes to a quantum critical point, which would then sort of go here. And what we see, when you look carefully, we see either some particle hole instability, or particle-particle instability, or some liquids that are not Fermi liquid. So at the example I showed you, we had three symmetry breaking transitions for magnetism, the pneumatic phase, and superconductivity. But we also have non-symmetry breaking states that are very interesting, the marginal Fermi liquid, and maybe the skirmion liquid state. And it could be that, and they were not visible in the early samples. It's something that showed up as the samples got cleaner and cleaner. Could it be that when you start over again with another phase here, that you end up with a hierarchy, a repetition of the same phenomena in sufficiently clean samples, and that this just keeps going? And so then one would imagine that quantum critical point is kind of like birthplace of never-ending complexity. And the reason you don't see this, of course, is because you're going to be cut off by disorder. So for example, quench disorder normally cuts you off here, maybe here, and so on. And we never actually see the other phases. That is a possibility. And it makes you wonder whether biological systems, which are non-equilibrium, and I don't want to draw close analogies to these problems, but a non-equilibrium system, but could biological system be a bit like that? And that we think our samples are clean, but a biological material, a DNA, is in some sense self-correcting and purifying over vast scales of order miles. But it's not done in the laboratory with somebody fine-tuning the material growth condition. It's done by a self-correcting mechanism. So if we want to see these kind of states, we have to figure out how to make samples a different way. A way that would actually involve a self-correcting scheme built into the process, and maybe at some stage that will come. Thank you, then.
Is it actually like Mason's question? Don't you want the central on this hierarchy? We have this big transition, say, separating, you know, ferromagnet from normal metal. Doesn't that line have to continue through? And then you get your superconducting, your ferromagnetic superconductor, superconductor and normal, and then at the next level, so aren't those?
Apparently, yes, because as you said, the superconductivity coexisted with ferromagnetism.
Yeah.
And worse than that, the non-symmetry breaking state would be hard to incorporate in this kind of picture.
Yeah.
So essentially, this is maybe a point at which one can make it thinking about some sort of phase diagram that's more general, that includes those effects. Yeah. But actually, there is a point here that in particle physics, one thinks in terms of higher and higher energy. But in condensed matter science and in biology, for example, it's really this scale that's interesting. Long time, low energy, where you might think, well, what can happen? If you go to absolute zero, nothing happens. We're saying that this is a very, very incorrect way of thinking. That actually, you should be thinking of one of the temperature, and then more and more things happen. And that biological systems are in essence like that. And I think everybody agrees, a lot of things are happening there.
Thank you.